Welcome to A Cult of Personality, Esoteric Podcast Extraordinaire. I'm your host, Greg Kaminsky, and you can find our website at occultofpersonality.net, featuring an extensive archive of recorded interviews. This is podcast episode number 152, featuring an interview with author Gabriel Roberts to discuss his book, The Quest for Gnosis. A Cult of Personality podcast is made possible by you, the listeners, and by the subscribers to the A Cult of Personality membership section. This episode is also made possible by additional donations from Steve, Diana, and Lance. Thanks again. A Cult of Personality podcast is also sponsored by Miskatonic Books, an online store that focuses on the esoteric, occult, ceremonial magic, Freemasonry, Rosicrucianism, witchcraft, the Golden Dawn, as well as dark fantasy, classic horror, and supernatural fiction. They carry books by all your favorite esoteric publishers as well. Just visit miskatonicbooks.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Thelesis Aura, an occult media production, education, and resource company. Publishers of Lon Milo Duquette's Tarot of Ceremonial Magic. Distributors of Kat Luneau's Sacred Imagery. And host to online training and instruction by some of the world's leading teachers of the esoteric arts. For more, visit ThelesisAura.com. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center, located in historic Salem, Massachusetts, offers unique instruction in the arcane arts from some of the most experienced and talented teachers around. The Hermetic Arts Learning Center is committed to the authentic Western esoteric tradition by providing students with quality, in-depth classes, along with all the books and ritual tools one could ever want, many of them handcrafted. The ancient mysteries have a new home in the Witch City. Stop by the shop or visit online at hermeticarts.com. A Cult of Personality podcast is also brought to you by Metabolic Alchemy, alchemical elixirs for health and personal development. Metabolic Alchemy offers alchemical elixirs based on the five elements of Western alchemy. Focus on one element, or take the complete journey through the elements program to refine all the elements of your nature. Metabolic Alchemy also produces wellness elixirs for sinus, sleep, energy, and relaxation. Visit metabolic-alchemy.com. Now, in episode number 152, an interview with Gabriel Roberts about his book, The Quest for Gnosis, Spirituality Beyond Dogma. Gabriel Roberts is a theological scholar, researcher, and public speaker whose specialization is discussing the nature of perception and belief. After 27 years of passionate searching and study, Roberts stepped away from his long-held Christian faith into a more expansive and fluid worldview. The details and reasons are cataloged in his book, Born Again to Rebirth. In his latest book, The Quest for Gnosis, he explores the roots of belief, the power of the ecstatic state in one's spiritual life, and the means by which a deeply satisfying spiritual life may be achieved outside the bonds of dogma. The book contains Roberts' transcribed interviews with many luminaries, including Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, Graham Hancock, Danielle Bolelli, Peter J. Carroll, Hamilton Morris, Dr. Aaron Cheek, David Metcalf, Randall Carlson, and Dr. Rick Strassman. Roberts is continuing his research at the University of Washington in Tacoma, as well as writing for Vice Magazine, Disinfo, and Reality Sandwich. Gabriel Roberts, I want to welcome you to A Cult of Personality podcast. Thank you very much for joining us this evening.
Thank you for having me.
It's my pleasure. So your new book is The Quest for Gnosis, Spirituality Beyond Dogma. Before we talk about your book, I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about your story.
Sure. I grew up in Tacoma, Washington as a Pentecostal Christian and an evangelical, and it's a very mystical version, I suppose, of American Christianity. It's the kind where people roll around on the floor and shake and speak in tongues and things like that. And basically get into their own set of ecstatic states. And I came out of that after 27 years, really feeling like I had been shortchanged, spiritually speaking. I felt like I'd been told a lot of things, but my own experiences told me something different. And because of that, it caused a lot of disillusionment. That, and there was a great disparity logically between a lot of things, you know, assertions like the earth being 6,000 years old and basic things like that. And, you know, I catalog that in my other book, Born Again to Rebirth. And ever since then, I kind of went into an existential void, and I realized that it was okay with the possibility that I could be completely wrong about everything, that there might not be any God, that there might not be anything spiritual at all, that it could all be in my head and all of these sorts of things. But you know, I had some pretty tremendous psychedelic experiences that catalyzed a lot of things and kind of brought me to some new realizations and what I believe to be some new epochs of thought and a gnosis of my own. So that's kind of where my path has led. Along that way, I got my degree in theology, Seattle Bible College. And now I'm continuing my education at the University of Washington in their graduate program. And yeah, I've been just writing and living a very interesting, wild life.
Excellent. That's great. So I'm curious about how you self-identify now in terms of your either religion, if that's what you call it, or spirituality or philosophy, perhaps.
Sure. You know, I think that Peter J. Carroll did an excellent job of describing neopantheism. And in fact, I actually did a YouTube video where I do a reading from his book, The Apophenion, in which I describe neopantheism. And I think that that really technically would best describe how I feel. But you can easily exchange that with a theosophist in many ways, mm-hmm. or a chaos magician in many ways. So essentially, yeah, that's how I would characterize myself. I believe that there is definitely some kind of spiritual interaction that's going on in the world, that there is some type of thing that is beyond us, things that are beyond our meat brain.
Something objective beyond our,
right.
ourselves. And, okay.
And we seem to see this evidence by realizing that even our consensus reality is a little bit wishy-washy. And so because of that, we can create our own gods in our mind. And that may not mean that that God is real to someone else, but definitely, you know, when people die, they have these visions, and, you know, they die and come back to life. If you're a Muslim, you see visions of Allah. If you're a Catholic, you see the Virgin Mary. If you're Protestant, you see Jesus. If you're a Buddhist, you see Buddha, and so on and so forth. And this has been cataloged over the years. So it seems to be that our minds have a great deal of power when it comes to what we believe. And in many ways, I believe that I can transform my own mind through kind of my own version of programming in that sense.
Forgive me, because I may simply be misunderstanding or just missing your point slightly, but when I think of an objective spiritual reality that exists outside of
whatever we are as we define ourselves, versus like the idea that we can use our minds to, in effect, almost, as you, I think you said, use the word create gods. To me, those are, and maybe it's a false dialectic, but it seems to me that those ideas are somewhat paradoxical.
Yes, well, I believe that is true. I believe that most truths, if not all, end in a paradox of sorts.
Mm.
You can always find a way in which something is true because truth is context dependent.
Mm-hmm.
Water is bad for you if, for instance, you are working on electrical lines and you're standing in a pool of water. But water is good for you if you haven't drank any water and you need to be hydrated. And that's maybe a silly example. So yes, it's truth is context dependent. Things are true in a certain place and time. What's true for us here may not be true if we were all floating in the dead of space billions of light years from here, and our situation might be entirely different. Hmm. We don't know because we're not there, so we have no point of reference. And that might be a more arbitrary example, but that's at least the way that I see things. I hold my beliefs very loosely because for 27 years, I thought I knew,
mm-hmm.
and it turned out I didn't. That I was very wrong, and I misled a lot of people, and it's something I don't want to do again. So I this is why in my book, The Quest for Gnosis, I allow the people that I interview to say their piece. I don't try to manipulate their words or change the context because I do or don't agree with it. What I actually do is I try to tie together these themes that come from very different aspects and points of view, and show how there are a lot of common themes, despite some very grand differences at times.
Maybe you could give us a definition of gnosis or some characteristics of what someone who would self-identify as a Gnostic nowadays are, but either based on your own opinion. There are different definitions people have at different points in time or throughout history, but I think it's important that we know what you're talking about, and we're all on the same page.
Well, I like to refer to it as gnosis in the modern context. And to me, there are two primary definitions that are key to a modern perception and or living out of gnosis. The traditional view is experiential knowledge. That's the traditional ancient Greek definition. It was a great example is pizza. You can talk about pizza. You can read a book about pizza. You can see people eating pizza on movies. You can have friends who have eaten pizza. But until you have eaten pizza yourself, you do not have gnosis on it. You must have experienced it to have a point of reference. And it's going from a tangible ignorance to a tangible experience. It puts the experience in the hands of the user rather than taking it upon someone else's authority. It's just like when anytime that you want to see evidence, people can make all kinds of claims, but until those claims can be backed up and you can peruse those things, it's very difficult for you to vet and verify that. And that's why we have a more logical process. So really, gnosis in that sense is simply experiential knowledge. We don't have to have somebody else tell us how to live our lives or that it's such and such way because it's written in this book. The good stuff is repeatable, is provable, can be seen.
One question I have for you is, in your opinion, how does one properly assess whether a given experience is in fact a Gnostic experience or maybe some lower grade revelation that's not quite gnosis?
I think that's a good question. Sorry. I think that the key would be just the way that I've heard Jackie Chan explain Kung Fu, right? He says that Kung Fu is everything, right? Well, obviously, cooking a meal is not kung fu to somebody who's never done kung fu. Or a magician might see magic in everything. In that sense, there are degrees of gnosis. I think it would be helpful also to give the second definition very quickly. The second definition of gnosis, as in Western magic, as in Western magical traditions, would be to bring yourself to a place of an ecstatic state known as non-mind, in which you are trying to overcome your basic everyday impulses and kind of tap into the more archaic aspect of yourself. And once you achieve this type of state, which it can be achieved in a myriad of ways, once you get into that state, you can kind of tinker around with your own mind and the way that you see the world. So that's the big thing, is that gnosis can be experienced, for instance, while you're at a Ziggy Marley concert, as has happened to me before, where I became absolutely lost in the moment, where I achieved a state of non-mind. And I don't mean thoughtlessness or stupidity. I mean a place in which all was clear and any kind of direct line or message, or that deep sense of connection that you feel with the divine, however you might say that, becomes very clear. But that's also happened to me when I was in Pentecostal churches. And every religion has a way in which this happens. And they use it as a point of reference and as a proof text for the validity of their religion. They say, see, this is real. And that's how you know it's real. But the problem is that all religions have this. And some are better at achieving these states than others. And they try to appropriate that and say it's only for them, but it's not a religious experience. It is a human experience. It has nothing to do in many ways with religion. Religion is just sort of the trappings and the packaging in which that occurs. So,
yeah, I like to see religion as actually the result of it, but it ends up getting corrupted anyway. So,
but this is why it's so integral for us to focus these things directly on what we are experiencing. And it's really hard for me to say, judging on someone else's life, what they've gone through, when something is or is not an actual point of gnosis. And I know that seems to make it a bit of a moving goalpost, but this experience that we have is so individually driven. The way that we see the world is completely different than the way that anyone else sees the world. We can find similarities, but our view of the world is like a fingerprint. And because of that, situationally, a moment of gnosis could come while you're watching your children playing, or while you're on psychedelic mushrooms, or while you're on a roller coaster, or while you're at the height of an orgasm. Virtually anything that derives pleasure or a heightened experience can cause one to go into a Gnostic state. But then again, if we're talking about spiritually, there is another aspect that comes with maturity, study, commitment, and things like that. And there are states and ways of being that cannot be achieved just by haphazardly stumbling through things for the average person. There's a reason why a carpenter who's been doing fine craft work with hand-built materials and finished products, who's been doing that for 25 years, you know that they have an intrinsic understanding that has far more depth than a kid who just built a wooden box in wood shop. It's a many-tiered approach in that fashion.
Yeah, I think that's a really important point you made there. Because, distinguishing between the lightning bolt kind of moment versus those moments that are cultivated over years of practice and devotion are probably not quite so comparable.
I think that that's what one thing that leads me to believe that there is some kind of loosely knit set of channels that we can go down in our life, kind of like a road, but it's a bunch of road signs. You don't have to, just because you see a road sign doesn't mean you have to go to that particular place. You just see the sign and see it's a possibility. And kind of in that sense, you have people who are capable of deciding how that goes, and you get a taste. When we see things, we get a taste of what is possible, and then it, in its own way, it says, do you like this? Because if you like this, you can go this way, and this can be something that's a part of your regular life. You don't like this? Well, maybe try this. And life sort of throws these things our way, and we decide what we like and how we go through that.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Now, I have a question, one more question, really, before we actually get into talking about your book, and that is, historically, one characteristic of groups or individuals or the philosophy or theology they adhere to, those that we identify as Gnostics, and that was a dualism of some sort, you know, the idea that the material world is corrupted, that it might have even been created by some sort of lesser god, not the true god.
Yes.
And I know there's degrees of dualism. You have mitigated dualism, which is probably closer to something like maybe even Hermeticism versus like the really hardcore dualism where, you know, all physical matter is totally corrupted and not redeemable. And I'm just wondering, you know, what your thoughts are about dualism and its place in the gnosis of today.
That's an excellent question. I think that the key to that is understanding that, I'll put it this way. I'll frame it by my own chosen belief. I have chosen to believe that I am here in this consensus reality for a reason, that I'm here to experience both the pleasure and pain of life. I'm supposed to experience what it's like to have a delightful meal with friends and family with a glass of wine. I'm supposed to experience what it feels like when the most beautiful girl I've ever been with crushes my heart. I'm supposed to feel what it's like to have to be the one to leave. I'm supposed to feel all of these experiences, both the pleasure and pain of life. And I feel like there is a time and a place for fasting, for removing yourself from your normal trappings. You know, this is the Hermetic voyage. This is the Joseph Campbell's hero's journey. This is where we step away from everything that we've known in order to transform ourselves and peel away the veneers and kind of the BS that we've built up over time. But I feel that for the average person who's living day to day, a life of asceticism or a life in which one claims that they cannot be pure unless they're completely untouched by the world, I think is not something that everyone is capable of doing, nor is it the only path to enlightenment. You know, in Eastern traditions, there are various paths to enlightenment. And I think that that is more accurate than a dualistic approach, because I've spoken with some hardcore people who come out of hiding just to talk. And because Gnosis is in the name of my book, they've had discussions with me and they've said, well, I don't want to associate with you because you live in the material world. You wear nice clothes and I've seen that you drink and I've seen that you've taken psychedelics. So you're not actually a true Gnostic. So there is that sense. And what I've come back and said is, well, I kind of explained the way that I have and explained that a lot of those states of being and a lot of the things that I do, I believe are a part of a well-balanced life, that there are times that I should absolutely cast myself away from the material world and to get rid of all of the garbage that gathers up. And there's a lot of garbage. But I also feel that enjoying life and living it to the fullest and following my heart in these matters is more integral than a path that came from people who didn't have the same amount of information that we have today and didn't have a cross-section like we have. The problem now is that we have so much information in every direction, it makes it virtually impossible to try to live in a vacuum or to not be stained by some bad piece of information. It's just because there's lots of information doesn't mean it's good. So it makes it more challenging for us. And I think that's one of the reasons why having a good grasp of what a fallacy is and how that works is a good idea. Yeah, I think that's why it's so integral to be clear about the definitions and to say that you can say, for instance, you can say Christian and you can go to Egypt and Christian means Coptic Christian, mm-hmm. which has little to nothing to do with an American megachurch. That they're so different that they're barely even the same name. And so it's the same with many terms.
Exactly. Yeah, that's a good point.
So that is one of the issues. So that's why I do my best to be very clear about these two definitions in my introductions to people. And when I describe it, I'm talking about either a long-term experience that comes from hard work and dedication or an ecstatic state that you can put yourself in through various means. Right, so right. I think that that's really a key.
Yeah.
Sure.
Thank you for making that clear. So to talk about your book, I think it's really interesting, unique. You've put together a series of, well, it's a lot of interviews and there's some essays or interjections in between some of them. Maybe you could tell us how you decided to put it together and what it prompted you to do it.
Okay. I think that, you know, over time I've been doing kind of the active search like a lot of people do and, meeting with a lot of these people and becoming friends with them in ways that I had no idea would occur and stuff like that. Things have just sort of come together organically in many ways, but I've learned some things. You know, I interviewed Hamilton Morris. He does the Hamilton's Pharmacopoeia with Vice magazine and writes for Harper's. He's a materialist. He's a scientist and a materialist. He believes that everything happens in the meat brain. And a lot of the stuff that I was into at the time, I was hanging out with, a lot of the Reality Sandwich crew. And the Reality Sandwich crew, a lot of those people were 100% ayahuasca. You know, that's all that's necessary. And then Hamilton comes along and he's like, well, you know, you can have these experiences and have nothing to do with a spirit inside of the vine. And it can still be transformative. And just because it's inside your mind doesn't make it any less special. And so this was kind of, that was the catalyst, I think, for having conversations with people who are in the same book, but not on the same page, so to speak, where you have such a disparity mm-hmm. Between people who are talking about the same stuff. And from that, I think that the balance that I found was kind of describing spirituality beyond dogma. You don't have to be dogmatic about what you believe. You can see what works. When I talked with Daniele Bolelli, who wrote the book Create Your Own Religion, he was talking about Bruce Lee's approach to Kung Fu. And he said Bruce Lee was a master of many forms, and he took all of those forms and broke them all down and got rid of the stuff that didn't work or that was just for show. Anything that wasn't as expedient as something else got tossed, and the better thing was put in its place. And so what came together was a hybrid. And that sort of hybrid is what I'm looking for in the modern spiritual pursuit. We have a lot of people who want to tell us how to live our lives and tell us what to do and tell us that they're the new leader, that they're the new religion and all of this. But what I believe is the reality is that we should supply people with the proper tools to make logical decisions, but also make room for the mystical and what would seem nonsensical to others, and allow them to build their own view based on the best information that we have available, both new and old. And I think that the core of what I'm trying to do is develop some of those core ideas that will allow people to run their own show and not have to be told, oh, you're doing it wrong, or things like that. Because I think that's an old way, and we really have to get past that if we're ever going to stop murdering each other because God told us to, and things like that. I mean, it's a real problem.
Yeah. I also find it interesting trying to, like, juxtapose that with the what you had mentioned earlier, the idea of, like, commitment to a path or working with a teacher or an established tradition, and how that, voluntarily, of course, is kind of radically different from what you're talking about, and kind of like making up your own mind and kind of like choosing, the path that, kind of feels the most comfortable or maybe works the best or something like that.
I suppose that the best way that I could frame that is to say that being an occultist myself, I understand, a lot of the things like Aleister Crowley talked about, going and devoting oneself to a particular god for several months and doing nothing for anything else, believing, devoting yourself, going as deep and hardcore as possible with that one particular deity until you experience an experience with that deity. And then once that happened, you drop it cold turkey and you go to another deity. Mm-hmm. And you go through that whole process again, and you kind of collect for yourself this pantheon, this sort of group. That's one kind of extreme example of it. Being non-fundamentalist on my worldview, I think it's fine. It's not to the benefit of the rest of the world, but I think that it's okay if someone's just like, I'm not going to be religious. I like making money, and I like to play with my kids, and I want to retire and move to, some beach, some sandy beach. And if that's all they're going to do with their lives, I don't really have any problem with that, so to speak. I feel it would be beneficial for society if all of us were really understanding that we're on our own little hero's journey, that we're all on our own. We could be the hero of our story. And whether that means that we're just devoted and faithful in our practice, or whether we decide one day, I'm just going to go to this Greek Orthodox church for the rest of my life, and I'm going to understand that not all of it is good and right and perfect, but I'm going to enjoy the nuances of it. And I think David Metcalf has been really good in showing me the benefit of that, because despite his breadth of knowledge, he really loves hanging out with some of the strange Southern Pentecostals and like snake handlers and things like that, because it's endlessly fascinating to him. And he lays out a very good argument for the occultist that the very best grimoires that you can buy these days can be found at Walmart in the Christianity section, because these guys, they play with thought forms. And I don't know if you've ever been in a hardcore Pentecostal Christian circle, but you'll sit there and people will pray for the blood of Jesus to wash over someone. And they actually imagine the blood of Jesus like coming from the sky and pouring all over this person. And any magician knows that this is totally magic. This is as magic can be. But because Christians don't know that that's what that is, they just go for it. So there's this arbitrariness that is kind of the way of the world. This world is full of chaos. Nothing's sitting still. We want so bad to grasp things, and we know that as soon as we grasp them, they slip through our fingers. And having the humility of knowing that we are impermanent, that we're not even the same person that we were 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago. We see the evidence of it, but we still want to deny it. We still want things to be concrete, but they just aren't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good point. I'm curious how you actually conducted these interviews. Were they done, in written form, or did you record them in audio and then transcribe them?
Well, that was one of the biggest challenges, because I interviewed over 20 people for this book, And some of them are easily accessible, and others are very difficult to get a hold of and have to be scheduled with months in advance. And because of that, it was highly contingent upon the person. And in order to be accommodating and in order to get the roster of quality individuals that I did, I really had to be flexible with the terms on which they were willing to play. So some people never wanted to talk on the phone, didn't want to do Skype. They only wanted to do written interviews. So I did written interviews with them. Some, even the style of the written interview was different, because sometimes I would just give them a list of questions that I had for them, and other times I would have it conversational. So you can see the difference between, say, my conversation with Disinfo writer and author Thad McCracken. We had an email conversation that went back and forth for, it lasted over the course of a week or two, where we just bantered back and forth on the ideas we were talking about. But, I talked to Peter J. Carroll, the founder of Chaos Magic, and he's a busy guy. So instead of doing that with him, I just sent him a list of questions and he answered them. With others, I was able to talk with Rupert Sheldrake on the phone and just have a conversation with him. I was able to have a phone conversation with Daniele Bolelli and Dr. Lou Graham and Jeremy Johnson. So it was really contingent upon the needs and what was best for the people I was interviewing. It was more important to have the conversation than being prissy over the format, so to speak. So I did have to do a lot of transcription, and I have to thank my transcribers, because I hate transcription. I hate it more than anything. It's awful.
It's hard work. So that's interesting. I do feel like you got a really interesting and strong mix of people you interviewed here. You mentioned a few of them. I don't know if you want to go down the list in case somebody doesn't want to go to the website and take a look at the book, but just maybe you could name off some of the ones you didn't mention already.
Oh, let's see here. Hopefully no one will be offended if I don't mention their name. Let's see. I've got Crystal Cole, Matt Staggs, Thad McCracken, Hamilton Morris, Rupert Sheldrake, Graham Hancock, Dr. Lou Graham, Odd Edges, Aaron Cheek, David Metcalf, Nick Margerison. Oh, it's going to start to get fuzzy now. Maja Dow, Daniele Bolelli. Come on, who else?
I think you got one here that I was actually really shocked at to see, Abby Martin.
Abby Martin, yes.
Russia Today.
I got Abby Martin. I got Peter J. Carroll, as I said, and several others. Abby is a fascinating person.
Yeah, I agree. She is fascinating. But if I had to pick one person that I was like, wow, that don't quite fit in the list, like she seems way more political than... philosophical, maybe I just don't know her well enough.
For sure, if anyone watches Abby's show on RT, they'll know that she's highly passionate about what
she's sure doing, yeah,
obviously. But that also she has definitely has two legs to stand on, and in the media, it's very difficult to do what she's doing, and she's been very open to me about talking about odd spiritual things. And we do talk about kind of spirituality on the political perspective. And so I wanted to get her take with that. And I felt that it was important to have that in there because of that. We cannot escape politics. We cannot escape the ways that people do things. And people are driven by their beliefs. And this is one of the things that I talk about. You know, I spend a lot of time discussing Robert Anton Wilson's reality tunnels and Gebser's vision of kind of the evolution of consciousness. And these things are very much driven by what we're fed in the media. So that's why I brought her on board for this. And also because she's not religious per se.
Right.
She's very much logic and reason driven. She's a Trivium girl, which is great.
Yeah, definitely. Now, a couple of people you interviewed, I've had on the podcast before, David Metcalf and Randall Carlson. Obviously, I think very highly of both of them.
Yes.
Tell us a little bit about your interview with Randall, if you don't mind.
So, Randall Carlson was excellent. I actually met him for the first time. We did a video on the Georgia Guidestones. Mm-hmm. About a month and some change ago, and I'm not sure when that will be out yet, but I'm looking forward to it. I think that Randall's work is so integral because it ties together the ancient with the modern and the future. I believe that what they're doing at Sacred Geometry International is very key because it shows us we don't know what happened back then. We don't know what's going on now, and we still have a lot to learn. And that, to me, was the best, one of the best things that comes to the table. And also, Randall's one of those people who can parse the sort of retro woo-woo ideas that we want to appropriate so that we feel more spiritual. This happens everywhere. Anytime you have... You were talking about it with kind of the people, the throwbacks, the throwback Gnostics and things like that, where I don't think that those things exist for us to go back to. It's kind of the same tiff that I would have with Terence McKenna on his idea of an archaic revival of us all kind of returning to the forest, so to speak. Okay. I don't think that we can. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that is our purpose or the direction we're supposed to go. I think that we are supposed to reintegrate and learn from nature. And he was, I think that he was right when he talked about learning from nature, how it does what it does and going through it. So I think that Randall is one of those characters who allows us to be able to see what is useful and practical from ancient knowledge and what is mysterious without having the trappings of too much of the, as I'm saying, the woo-woo, too much of the goofiness that comes with that. So that's what I appreciated about my conversation with him. And he gave just such excellent responses. I wouldn't even dare to try and to go as deeply as he did.
Who maybe surprised you that you didn't expect?
Man, the most surprising. Some of the answers that I got, I asked almost every single person what happens when we die. And my favorite one was Daniele Bolelli. He said, "I have no damn idea."
The most honest answer.
He said, "I have no damn idea." Some people said, "Well, we're worm food. Well, our body goes." You know, Dr. Lou Graham, who has his doctorate in studying ancient gnosis, he died. He had a near death experience and he came back. And he, you know, based upon everything that he's learned, he had a very compelling story to tell, which he tells in the book. And you know, from there, I think those were the two most compelling, was the simplicity of Daniele's answer, "I have no damn idea," to Lou Graham telling this fantastic near-death experience story, or as he wouldn't even call it a near-death experience, he would say it was my death experience. And between those two, I think that would be the most astonishing. You know, I know the people that I interviewed well enough that there weren't too many things that surprised me, but the depth of the answers were really wonderful. I thought that Anthony Peake and his description of a lot of the modern scientific discoveries that are going on and him meshing that with Philip K. Dick and his sort of manic vision of how the world is was really fascinating as well. I totally got into the Philip K. Dick theme several times in the book because I believe that if there has been a modern Gnostic visionary or prophet, that it would have been Philip K. Dick. And for those listening who don't know who he is, he's the guy who wrote Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep, which turned out to be the film Blade Runner. He did Minority Report, Total Recall, A Scanner Darkly, and several other great works. But it's, in his book Valis, he writes his own religious exegesis, and it is endlessly fascinating. So, yeah, I kind of rabbit trailed there, but
no, that's great. That's great. One final question here, really. I'm just keeping an eye on the clock. How did, you know, doing these interviews and putting together the book transform you personally?
You know, it was a practice of gnosis in and of itself, I think. It was like getting to the heart of the matter with people who have spent, in many cases, their entire life focused on one particular aspect of this subject. And because of that, you do get a distillation. Anybody who reads the book is going to find themselves blown away time after time. And it's not because of my writing. I hope that some things that I say blow people away, but I chose the people that I chose for a reason. It's because they are fantastic. They are some of the greatest minds on this subject in the world. And because of that, it's definitely changed me in many ways. Perspective wise, it's forced me or reminded me to remain open-minded to good ideas, not to just any ideas, but to good ideas, ones that resonate well with me, and to be willing to remain humble, that I'm not a big smarty pants. I'm just a dude trying to figure things out just like everybody else. And I found myself in kind of a sense of wonder over and over how all of these people could be so inspiring and so different and see the world so differently. And because of that, it kind of encouraged me to be willing to explore the space. Like, I don't have to do things the way that I used to do them. I can change. And I think that that's one of the key elements that is found throughout the book, that we can change. We can change our perspective. We can change our life. We can stop being a Taoist, and we can switch it up, and we can be a Pentecostal for a while if we want to, or we can be an atheist, or we can be a magician. We can do whatever we want, and we can find the virtue and the value in that. And I guess putting those things into practice is key. I can talk about ecstatic states, but if I never meditate, if I never do the things that are necessary to get myself to that place, it's just a bunch of talk. And so I've been doing my best to really focus on that, because gnosis is personal experience. So if I'm not having the personal experience, it's not really worth anything. And so that's very much encouraged me, you know, with these conversations of people who have lived devoted lives, to learn what they've learned and to share what they've shared. And I'm just blown away and inspired by the people who've shared with the book.
Yeah, I'm as well. I think you have done something great in terms of putting this together and delivering it to the public. I would encourage people to read the book. I think it's full of really thought-provoking conversation and dialogue and ideas, and will make you think. And I think it's important because the people you're talking to are, as you said, they're kind of at the forefront of their fields, respectively, and having access to conversations with all of them in one place is really, really special.
Yeah, and the other thing that's great about it is if you don't like three of the people that you read, you can read 17 others that will inspire you. And each of those people in their own field has tons of books. I mean, it's like a starter kit. The book is a starter kit for getting your mind blown and changing, you know, the way that you see the world. I mean, many of these people I've read multiple of their books, and there's, man, tens of thousands of pages of material that you could go through just by reading the works of the people that I've interviewed, and I recommend it.
Yeah, it's literally endless. I mean, you could read their work, and then you could read those that inspired them, and then you could even go back to the primary sources. I mean, it's literally endless. But you've cracked the door open in a way that's really accessible for anybody who wants to check it out.
Yeah. Well, good. That was the idea.
Yes. In the coming weeks, A Cult of Personality podcast will feature more great interviews and recordings, including Angel Millar returning to discuss Freemasonry and Islam, Craig Williams talking about his wonderful book, The Cave of the Numinous, the recording of the Voices of Modern Gnosticism panel discussion, and much, much more. Thank you for listening, and until next time.